Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, all theater lovers, both out and proud and on the DL, and welcome back to Broadway Breakdown, a podcast discussing the history and legacy of American theater's most exclusive address, Broadway. This series is called The Big Move, and it is covering shows that had so much success off Broadway that they just had to transfer to the Great White Way and try some luck over there. My guest today is an alum of the pod, friend of the pod. You know her, you love her. Please welcome back Jessie Field.
Why, it's a sheer delight to be here, Matt. Thanks for having me back.
Every time you think you're escaping, I pull you back in.
I don't want to escape. Keep me nice and trapped.
Yes, it's Saw 7, baby.
Hey, God, they did make a lot of Saw movies, huh?
They did, and I did not see a single one of them.
And I saw every one of them because I am a lesbian.
A lesbian? You've seen Fleabag, I assume.
Actually, no, shockingly.
Oh, no.
I know, I'm a monster. I need to. It's on the list, but
you know, it's first of all, it's fantastic, so it's worth seeing. But for some reason, there's a line Olivia Colman has in the first episode of the second season, and the joke is that she is saying lesbian, but she gets cut off halfway through the word. Like it cuts to the next scene. She goes, "The interesting thing about father over here is that his mother was originally a lesbian." And it's It's great. Also, apologies anyone for sound quality on this episode. For some reason, Zoom has decided not to connect with my very professional Snowball microphone. So I have to use the crappy Apple laptop microphone. And so I don't know how I sound. I know how Jessie sounds. Beautiful and intelligent and magnificent.
And a little congested today, so apologies for that. But God, it's winter, ain't it?
It is winter, ain't it, henty? And besides, you know, the show we're talking about today, there's plenty of congestion here.
You're so right, Matt.
Jessie Field of Dreams. What? Please tell me someone's done that to you before.
I'm not sure. Field trip is a lot.
No, that's stupid. Children are stupid.
Gorgeous. I'm going to get a sweatshirt that says that.
You as well, you should. Jessie Field of Dreams. What piece of drama are we discussing today?
Oh, today we are discussing The Heidi Chronicles by Wendy Wasserstein.
Show enough. Now, do you have any history with this play?
Yeah, well, not really, but except that.
I really do, except that I don't.
Except that I have no history with it at all, except at one point in my life, my mother handed me a collection of Wendy Wasserstein's, which just contained Uncommon Woman and also The Heidi Chronicles. And she said, "You probably should read this, Jessie, as a living woman in theater." And I said, "Thanks." And one day, much later, I did.
Yes.
I think that the handing down from the mother feels very relevant in terms of what we'll be discussing here today. It was exactly that. Yes.
Yeah. This is I am holding the compilation of The Heidi Chronicles, Uncommon Women and Others, and Isn't It Romantic?
Yes.
When I was in college, we actually read Isn't It Romantic for Languages of the Stage, and I don't know why we read that and not The Heidi Chronicles, but
that is interesting. That's actually the only one in the collection I never got around to reading, and now I don't know where the collection is, but I'll buy it again.
I'm assuming then you've been familiar with Wendy Wasserstein for a while then, as a female writer.
As a female writer, which I am also, one simply must be familiar with Wendy Wasserstein.
Well, every single female writer that there is, which is one of the humorous things of the opening monologue of Heidi Chronicles. Where it's like, being a woman in art, I have to know about every woman in art. And the, I mean, the irony of that is she does, because no one else will. But she's like, I resent the idea that I have to, even though I do.
And I agree with that. And also, of course, I do and I want to.
Yeah. And it's also, she says, like, it's easy because there are many, but there aren't that many documented. So it's like the list isn't very long. I have plenty of room in my brain for other things.
Mm-hmm. You know, and as always, Wendy Wasserstein knows what's up.
She do. Having now read it, how does it compare to Uncommon Women and Others for you and any other Wasserstein works?
Gosh, well, I think she certainly, like, she has a style and she's very herself. The Heidi Chronicles, to me, it just feels so personal. Long before I looked up that it was so personal, I think it just, like, it rings with a truth that feels very Wendy, and it feels very, it's like primal femininity in a way of I don't know what everybody thinks femininity means, but to me it's like a grappling with something in the world. It's like something in us, and it just speaks very truly to that. I think most of her work rings with the truth of like reaching out to other women. Mm-hmm. It has like an honesty to it where I'm like, I believe you, and also this probably has happened to you, and like, sorry about it. Thank you for telling me. But the Heidi Chronicles has always stuck out to me simply because I'm like, God, is this just the life of Wendy Wasserstein? Like, it's, which it is. I mean,
yeah.
But before you know that, you feel that. I think that you can always feel honesty in a piece. And that is what draws me to Wendy Wasserstein the most, is I feel like she is trying to tell us something because something has happened to her and we should know about it. And then, of course, every woman in the world at some part or another goes, oh, God, me too.
Yeah. Well, so I think Wendy Wasserstein is probably one of the best, most successful examples of write what you know, right? That's what they always tell you when you write. Especially when you start out, because sometimes the issues is just like, you know, God, what ideas do I have? What concepts for a plot could I have? And for someone like myself, where, you know, dialogue tends to come easy, it's the story structure that's a little more difficult. It's harder sometimes to see the forest for the trees with that. And Absolutely. So I always just kind of write with what I know first, and then start tweaking things for, you know, other, you know, whatever. But you read Uncommon Women and Others, which is not her first play, but it is her, the first play that really kind of made her known in New York theater, which is interesting because it wasn't like this big phenomenon. It had a small off-Broadway production at Marymount Manhattan with Glenn Close, by the way. Oh, yeah. And like, it didn't run for years and years. It ran for like, I think, 2 months in a, you know, limited run or whatever. But it caused enough of a stir, at least in the play theatrical scene, that it got done across the country and other, you know, regional nonprofit theaters, and they were able to make a TV movie out of it with Meryl Streep before she was like, you know, Meryl Streep. Yeah. And sort of with each successive play that Wendy did in New York, her profile got larger. And so Heidi Chronicles, I mean, I'm not familiar with Sisters Rosenzweig, which is supposedly, some people claim it's a better play than Heidi. But when you sort of look at Wasserstein's career and then see how, when Heidi came out, it just sort of felt like a culmination of, okay, this playwright we've been watching for the last 10 years on the rise, she's good, and each play just gets better and more successful. So now here we finally have something that has crossover appeal. Isn't It Romantic played off Broadway for almost 2 years. It actually ran longer than Heidi Chronicles, but in, you know, the Lucille Lortel, which is about a fifth the size of the Broadway theater Heidi Chronicles was at. So more people saw Heidi Chronicles. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it sort of was a upward trajectory for her, where she kind of, the thinking in the 90s was that she eventually plateaued with Heidi and Sisters Rosenzweig, which is not to say that she did poorly, but it's like, oh, she reached the top and then pretty much stayed at the top and then wavered and like hovered around there for the remainder of her career. But it's, yeah, and also she died very young. So I don't know. Her career is an interesting one to me. Also, similar to Harvey Fierstein with Torch Song Trilogy, and I've realized now that the play that I've started writing is actually very much a blend of Heidi Chronicles and Torch Song Trilogy.
Uh-huh.
Hallelujah. What make her and Harvey Fierstein such successful writers and writers that can connect to people is that while there is so much truth in it, because it is so much of their lives, it is not, it does not feel like a therapy play.
No.
It's very funny. It's very insightful, and it doesn't punish the audience by being like, I feel like I'm afraid now to ask you if you've seen certain TV shows at the risk that you haven't watched them now, like Friends or Happy Endings.
I certainly have seen Friends.
Okay. There's that like one woman play that Chandler sees that he thinks everyone else is going to go see with him. Alex Borstein's the like actress of it. And it's called Why Don't You Like Me? And she shouts at Chandler's face, "Why don't you like me?" And Happy Endings, there's another one where like they're going to deaf poetry for women, and it's a woman like shaving her armpit, and she's like, "You made me go to prom. Are you happy now, mom?"
I love plays within TV shows. Very funny to me always.
Yeah, I love how TV writers are so condescending to theatrical writers.
And they're not like fully wrong. I've seen a lot of plays that are like that.
Oh yeah.
Not by Wendy Wasserstein, but
this is the thing about writing, and it's why whenever I do write like reviews on Instagram, I'm always aware of, first of all, how hard it is to just create something and then to have it get put up. Like a lot of work goes into it, but also anyone could technically put pen to paper, right? We all have thoughts.
Yeah.
I assume.
I certainly do. Although all I know is that I think, therefore I am. I'm taking you on good faith that you think.
Jesse, do you really think I've had you on here for a third time because I thought you have no thoughts?
Listen, I was a philosophy minor in college. I have doubts, but
I have such doubts. We've all heard you on the Candide episode. We know you know about philosophy. God damn it, Jesse, stop showboating your resume.
What a relief.
I'm like, let's talk about Broadway, and you're like, here are my credentials. Not going to get discovered on this podcast, Jesse. If I haven't been discovered yet, you won't.
I don't want to be discovered. It sounds like a big nightmare. Then people would look at me. Only you can look at me, Matt. Everyone else can hear my voice only. I know you're very lucky.
My chin in my hands. I'm so pleased.
You can see my matching plaid and beanie.
Your matching beanie, Feldstein. So the point I'm trying to make, though, is, you know, many people have thoughts. Right. Mm-hmm. And anyone could technically put pen to paper and start putting words down. Mm-hmm. And it takes a certain level of insight and skill to be able to communicate something to a mass audience. Mm-hmm. It's really, you don't want to preach and you don't want to placate and you don't want to punish. Avoiding those traps is how you actually really create a dramatic work that can really hit home and live with people, right?
Absolutely. It takes a lot of like big picture viewing too, especially if you're pulling from your own life where it's so easy to get wrapped up in things that feel big and like so many points of contention, but you're looking at the Heidi Chronicles, which jumps through so much time, and the way in which you like Wendy pulls out the moments that really matter in the narrative, and they matter not just because they matter to her. Obviously it's not literally her, but she knows how to build the arc to tell the story. And as you said earlier, it's so easy to get lost for the trees in the forest.
Yeah. And the thing about this play is like nothing overtly traumatic happens to Heidi, at least from what we see in the play. She comes from a good background. I mean, the whole play is about boomers and might be one of the first American plays to really kind of explore the boomer generation, at least, you know, at that point, because this premiered off Broadway at Playwrights Horizons, that's why we're covering it, in the winter of 1988, and then quickly transferred to Broadway at the beginning of 89. It extended the Playwrights Horizons until mid-February. They had 9 days off before they started previews at the Plymouth Theater, now the Gerald Schoenfeld Theater, where it ran for a year and a half. And I mean, you think about what it was up against for the Tonys that year. It was up against Lend Me a Tenor, which is, you know, a fun farce that unfortunately has some blackface in it. Then we have Shirley Valentine, which is a one woman show that transferred from the West End about a housewife who gets taken for granted by her family and then decides to leave them when she gets to go on holiday with her friend to Greece. And she's like, oh, or maybe it's Italy. But she's like, oh, the world is fun when you're not making tuna sandwiches every day for your husband and stupid titty sucking parasite kids. And she leaves them. And then the fourth play was called Largely New York, which was a comedy performance clown piece by Bill Irwin.
What?
Bill Irwin got his start as like a clown and like sort of performance artist. And he created this piece with a bunch of other performers. They did it at the St. James Theater, where it ran for about 4 months. And those were the four plays. And of those four plays, only Heidi Chronicles was actually talking about the people who were now the adults, who they had been the rebellious generation. They fought for civil rights and they fought for women's lib. And then we get to the 80s and they either are all making money and doing coke, or or they're not making money and they're, you know, and they're miserable. Or not that money makes you happy, but like there's so much misery in this generation because they were the first generation to really ask out loud, can I do with my life what I want to do? Can like I make a living doing what I'm passionate about and like making a difference? And their parents' generation were like, no, you make money to buy food and you marry someone because you need to make the babies.
For sure. God. And it was a very in-between time. I mean, that recurring question in Heidi is a very old question, I feel like, for women, which is the question of, can a woman have it all?
Mm-hmm.
which is now an old question. But of course, when it came out, the play is set. It starts and ends in 1989, which when it came out in 1988, and it goes back to 1965. So it's just funny to think about. We're all on like this large generational journey, and it sort of ends with that thought as well, which I'm sure we'll get to. But it's just like, it's such a time period, and it's such a way that people felt, and women's lib was so new, and like we're going through the AIDS crisis, and it's like all in this play. And it's such a time capsule now, whereas back then, I'm sure it was the moment. That's what everybody was feeling.
I mean, the thing about the play is like, it doesn't feel so revolutionary now. It just feels so human now and like very, and it still resonates. And you're like, oh yeah, this is still very relevant. It's just no longer like mind-blowingly like, oh my God, somebody said it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just now like very, it's very true. And it feels like stepping back into that time, which I don't think about all the time. I live in the now, baby, but you know, I love history and it's so potent.
Yeah.
And I love looking back at the journey it took for all of us to get here. I mean, not that we have arrived fully anywhere. May I note, still no equal pay across genders, but what can one do about that? One wonders every day.
Well, after you get discovered on this podcast, we really will make change.
Well, thank God. Then I'll finally do equal pay for women, which I a playwright. It's the only reason I got into the theater was to get equal pay. It's a good strategy that will definitely work is how I feel
Absolutely.
About it.
It's noble and it's smart and it's efficient. It's a very good fast track.
Thank you, Matt, for noticing.
yeah. I mean, so I knew of this play for a long time. I read it eventually in college after we read Isn't It Romantic, which is... If Uncommon Women and Others, which I don't think is like, I don't find that play terribly funny, but also I've never seen it done live on stage with an audience. Like I've just read it and seen clips of the TV movie. There's a little bit of gross out humor to it. Like the thing that sticks in my brain forever is Susie. There's like in a flashback in college in the early 60s and Susie Kurtz comes out and she goes, I tasted my period blood. And I'm like, that's an opening line. That's an opening line.
You know, you just won't forget it.
No, you didn't. That's not something you forget. But after Isn't It Romantic is far more of a comedy. It's, you know, a single woman, it was similar to Heidi Chronicles, single woman, can she have it all? But it's a little more focused on romance and maturity, because she's like, you know, she's always like Ms. Wasserstein herself, cracking the jokes, deflecting, doing the things. And her parents like, well, when are you going to settle down and find a nice mensch? And yeah. And the play doesn't, from what I remember, the play doesn't end with her like having it all, but rather it kind of ends with her letting go of the expectations of it all. And so then she can kind of just start living life. And if she finds any of those things, great, but it's not about adhering to what's expected. And Heidi Chronicles, I feel like, is a little less, it's less effervescent, it's less bubbly. It's still funny. You either shave your legs or you don't.
Yeah.
Which it's times like that where I'm like, I wish I had an old Brooklyn, you know, grandmother. I mean, both my grandmothers are from here. One lived in Brooklyn, one lived in Queens, but they aren't like that. You either shave your legs or you don't. They drink white wine and scotch. That's who they are. But the ending of the play is much more sort of, I think, like a realistic and mature understanding of balance. It's because, I mean, no one really ever has it all. Anyone who says that they do is fucking lying to you.
Yes.
It's about letting go of the things that you'll never get and appreciating what it is you have and always trying to do better, not for the sake of fulfillment, but just because that's what gets you out of bed in the morning. You know, like Heidi has all these accomplishments by the end of the play. She becomes a doctorate of her field. She wrote a book about women in art that somehow was very successful and like kind of was a cultural moment, apparently. Am I making that up? I feel like they talk about like her book like made an impact.
Yeah, no, they do. They're on the news show, not that she gets to speak on it, and they bring it up somewhere else as well. The Women's Lunch, I think.
Yeah, well, my guests know what that's like to go on the air and never get to speak.
Not at all. I never shut up, I feel.
And yet somehow, Jesse, I love talking over you and everyone.
Listen, you got to be yourself, Matt. Don't crush your spirit.
Be yourself. No, there's a difference. You can, again, it's all about balance. You accept who you are and the flaws that you have, but that doesn't mean you say, you know, accept my flaws, I'm never going to change. You work on them still.
Absolutely. And you learn, well, I think also, gosh, you learn that in life, nobody can have it all because there's simply not enough time. There's
no
time in every day. You have to pick things. And every time you pick something, you run out of time for something else. This is like the Rachel Carson phenomenon that I alone speak about, which is that when Rachel Carson, marine biologist, was in college, she was paralyzed at a library because she said, if I read this book, that means that's one book I won't have time to read before I die. Every choice I make eliminates something else. And nobody can have it all. And I love in the Heidi Chronicles that insane speech she gives at her, I think, alma mater, where she tells the story of her perfect day, where she leaves teaching and goes to an exercise class and cooks a mesquite chicken dinner for her husband and her children, and then takes the leftovers to a homeless shelter and has sex in the kitchen and writes 10 pages of her novel. And of course, that's not a real day anybody could ever have. And there were like 45 more things in it too, because Wendy Shore can weave a yarn, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I remember she included things like learn some more Italian. Drops the children off, picks the children back up, tells her very handsome younger like tennis instructor that they can't be lovers, like it's
we can only be friends.
We can only be friends, things like that. There's so much in life that you cannot control. There are the elements, there are other people. So when it comes to relationship, marriage, kids, like it's so hard. I've talked about this already before, and I will talk about it again. Like, it is so hard to find someone you like who likes you back, and you're both in a place where you can be together. It's like auditioning. It's a numbers game.
Absolutely. And some of it is random. And back in the day, and even I would say now, you feel like if you don't find that, you're failing something.
Yeah.
But especially, I would say, at the time, for women who have this clock ticking to have children by a certain age, and children are also a modicum of success. And there's like a real liberation from that in the Heidi Chronicles with the ending, which of course ends with her adopting a child on her own.
Yeah.
I think is so empowering, because you look back, like even at the scene where she's at the women's support group, which is like my favorite scene of the whole play, with Fran the lesbian, who's like my favorite 2-minute character in the whole play, obviously.
Of course.
And she's talking about this guy and how he is in control of how she feels about herself. And I think many of us have been there in terms of like letting a relationship define our self-worth, whether we want to or not. It just sometimes happens. Like, and I don't blame people for feeling that way, because it's very easy to love yourself when someone is standing there loving you. But when it's you on your own, you know, you have to maybe work a little harder or think about it a little different. And when all your friends maybe are all married and having children, are you measuring yourself up to their success? Do you think that's real happiness? Is that real love? But you've got to find it and define it for yourself. And there's no real measure for success, happiness, or love.
So the guy that she's referring to is Scoop.
Scoop Rose Thumb.
What a name.
What a name. What a newsman.
Yeah, this, it's a little on the nose that he's, when we meet him, he's a journalist and his name is Scoop.
Like, pretty funny. Pretty
silly. I got the scoop. but yeah, like, I will say, and I was reading some of the reviews of the show at the time, and the New York Times, when it was at Playwrights, pointed on something that I agreed with, was like, if there's one real major flaw in the play, like, we can pick anything apart, and I think this is a really lovely play. My one flaw is I do not get the appeal of Scoop, and I think when we first meet him, he is such a douche, like, and not in a way where it's like, oh, like, are you messy or are you a bastard? And like he just comes out, I'm like, oh, you're an asshole. And it's something that I have to see, like, Peter Friedman do in the original, because I saw the revival. And I just thought that Jason Biggs was so uncharismatic in the role that it was like, you need to at least buy what would draw Heidi to him to begin with.
I don't know. This is a hot take from Jesse Field, because I certainly agree he sucks and I would never, but then I'm a full lesbian, so he can't trust me. But I think it's deeply true that a guy like that, like, we just fall for the worst people.
Yeah.
And from the outside, it's so easy to look at. I cannot tell you how many of my poor beloved straight friends that I have, poor lost lambs that they are, fall in love with these people, these extraordinary women with these ordinary men. No offense, not to stereotype it like that, but I do see it all the time. And I think, why? This makes no sense, but they're just obsessed with them.
I mean, there's that thing like the game, right? The game with the negging and all that shit.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
But it's like the confidence. I think there's that line. Although I was just last night watching the movie version with Jamie Lee Curtis of the Heidi Chronicles. Mm-hmm. And so I know that has now messed up like what I remember to be a play line and a movie line, although they're largely the same, but not fully. Yeah.
I can't imagine they're that different. It's a TV movie. They have the ability to stay pretty faithful to the play.
And they mostly did, but there were a couple lines where I was like, that wasn't in the play, and I kind of dug it. Sometimes where I was like, shut up, go back to the play. This part where she's talking to Scoop, actually this is for sure in the play, she's talking to Scoop and she says, I have to find out like what mothers tell their sons that they don't tell their daughters that make them so fucking confident.
Yeah.
Like, how are you, where does that come from? And confidence is irresistible. I believe it. I don't like it for Heidi. It's a huge bummer for me to watch her sort of go through that. But I'll tell you, I believe that she's there thinking about Scoop and not Peter, even before she knows Peter is gay.
Oh, yeah. Well, she knows it. She acknowledges it. The thing about Heidi, and it's something that I very hard relate to. Like, I also want to make very clear, her situation with Scoop, at least for Act 1, because they do get to a place in Act 2 that's healthier for her. But because he's also just a fucking mess. But the Act 1 relationship, I absolutely get, because honestly, I've lived it. I'm
we've
coming
all
out
been there, Matt. We can all admit it. We've all admit there.
We've all had our scoops. But people always say like, oh, people tell you who they are when you first meet them, and it's like, that is true. But also, sometimes you don't know that that's what they're telling you when you meet them, right? Yeah. Sometimes they show you the best side of themselves. And the very fact that they are hiding the other side tells you all you need to know about them. But you don't know that that's what they're doing in the moment. And it's only over time, once you've got hooks in them and they've got hooks in you, that you start to see the other stuff. And similar to what we were saying earlier, like, sometimes it's hard to tell when a person's flaws are things that are red flags or when they're things that you can work through. And the high you get from being loved or being attended to by someone you love and attend to, it's like, oh, I think you're so awesome. The very fact that you think I'm awesome makes me feel even better. And like any confidence you already had, anything you thought about yourself just gets like heightened. It's this big euphoric dopamine.
Very much so.
Yeah. And so when Heidi's in that women's support group in the, you know, deep trenches of women's lib around like 1970-71, she's talking about Scoop, right? And she's saying, you know, okay, yes, I see him every couple of weeks. I usually go see him. He dates other women, but I'm like, and I am being treated like crap. And they're all like, he sucks. She's like, yes, no. She's like, he does. She's like, I'm aware he sucks. She's like, the problem is not him, because he do suck. The problem is that I stand there and let him do it. He's like, and I can't tell you why. I really don't know, but I am aware that I shouldn't. She's like, and in a weird way, it's sort of like saying it out loud is her first steps of being able to get past it.
Yes, it's a gorgeous scene. That's my favorite scene of the whole play, is that meeting. And I don't really know why. I just love to reread it and read that group of women. It's the way they talk to each other. And they're all like, I love you, Susan. No, I love you, Fran. No, this is the greatest woman in the world, Fran. Yeah.
Well, for me, what I like about that scene, because it is a good scene, it's very funny, but it's also got a lot of emotion to it, because Becky, that's the young one, right? Who, fun fact, at Playwrights was played by Sarah Jessica Parker, and then when it moved to Broadway, was played by Cynthia Nixon.
So funny.
And then Sarah Jessica Parker took it over again when later on in the run. So I just love that two of the Sex of the City foursomes played that role.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, or series of roles, Becky, Denise, and somebody else. But because there's some overlapping or doubling of roles in this show. But they all come from different walks of life, and they're all very different personalities from each other, right? And I think Wasserstein is able to highlight some of the humorous ridiculousness of this meeting while also tapping into the humane realities of their circumstances. So like the very fact that they're like, anytime somebody arrives, like, I'm so happy you're here, like they have a ritual that they have to do. It's like the I see you.
And it's italicized just so. Susan, it is so good to see you. Hello, Susan. It is
so good to see you. Yes. You either shave your legs or you don't. And it's like someone speaks their truth and they go, thank you, Susan. I love you. Thank you, friend. I love you. And it's all meant in the name of sisterhood and support and having a community. And that's all well and good. But the humor of it is the audience can recognize that this is like something that, not that they, even if they mean it, it is a little performative, because it's now become a ritual. Like it's just habit now. They do it because that's what you do once you're in the group. That's what you have to say. And that's the humor. But then you hear things like Becky's whole situation being still in high school, and like both of her parents are gone, and she now lives with her boyfriend because who else is she going to live with? And she has to like go in the bathroom just to think and cry.
Yep.
Yeah. Really.
You're
like,
hey, that's real. And it's the whole thing. You're right. It's playing with this push and pull, because it's, I would say, one of the funniest scenes in the play. And also one of the ones that contains like the truths that really arrested me. My favorite part of it, which I just pulled up over here so I could read you this exact line from Heidi, which she says, Becky, I hope our daughters never feel like us. I hope all our daughters feel so fucking worthwhile. Do you promise we can accomplish that much, Fran? Huh? Do you promise? I love that she takes that question to Fran. I love that she is like begging Fran, the wise lesbian, to confirm for her that although we may suffer today, like our daughters in the future are going to go further and be more liberated. And this is like the beginning of that generational thread for me too. Mm-hmm. And it's a thought that I think about this all the time, like how far we can get generationally, and like the the things that I'll never be able to let go of in my own psyche, and then thinking about the art I want to make and how I can tell people they're okay so the next generation can feel a little less terrible. And over time, we're all going to move towards feeling less terrible, one might hope, if we make the right art. And I just love the way that Heidi, who like was not really super into this meeting when she arrived, is now like begging Fran to promise her that their daughters will feel more worthwhile than they do. And then of course they also love you, Heidi.
I think that's something to remember with this meeting, because it's early, the way that it's structured, you know, this is, we have, you know, Heidi's first, the play has two major monologues that open both acts where she's giving a lecture on women in the arts. And, you know, of course, it relates to the rest of the themes of the play. But then, as you said, like, we go back from the early 60s through the 80s, and we have her first meeting at a dance where she meets Peter, who becomes her, like, soulmate, even though we eventually find out he's gay, which actually makes him even more perfect for her, because the lack of complication of a romance means they can just be there for each other. And, like, with no strings, with no no skin in the game, other than the fact that they just both want to be there for each other. And then the next scene is 2 years later where she meets Scoop, and then 2 years later where we have the women's meeting. But it's interesting you say that that line is like her pleading to Fran. And I think it's true. I think you can also almost read it as not like an interrogation, but like almost kind of argumentative as well to Fran. Because of everyone in that group, Fran is the most like, strong in her beliefs of like what women can be, what they should be, men suck, blah blah blah. And it can be a little, and her whole mantra, you either shave your legs or you don't, it's very black and white for her. Like, you either are a feminist or you're not. You either stand up for yourself or you don't. And Heidi doesn't necessarily think of herself as a feminist in this moment. The key phrase she has when she arrives with her childhood friend Susan is, I'm just visiting. But I feel like when she turns to Fran on that, of like, can you promise that? It's both like a plea and also like, can you promise that, Fran?
Sure.
Like, you're going to hold us accountable. Can I hold you accountable? Because, you know, the truth is that you're not going to, no one of us can make a perfect human, raise a perfect human, make sure that they are not just like empathetic to a beautiful degree, but able to take care of themselves and strong-willed and never get hurt or abused and can love and support and create. And it's sort of really shitty to expect everyone to follow a gold standard when none of us ever can. We can keep trying and learn from our fuck ups and hopefully fuck up less in the future. But yeah, I think there's it's a combination of a plea and a confrontation to Fran with that. Can you promise that?
Yeah, I totally agree. And that's what's fun about the play too, is there's so much to it. And there are so many ways you can read this. I had so much fun watching clips of the play and also TV movie, because I want to hear how people say these lines. I mean, I guess that's really the joy of theater, why we're all, it's so alive.
Oh,
and
there's
so much here to sort of interpret.
Did you say interpret?
I sure did. It was a folksy thing, like a charming, I'm being charming.
Yes, you are. Okay, I say, okay, Catherine O'Hara. you must interpret the text, David. But yeah, I mean, in eighth grade English, our teacher, whenever we would study plays, we were not allowed to read them at home. We had to read them in class with each other, because she said plays are meant to be heard, not read.
So correct. God.
So correct. And Heidi Chronicles, it's often hard sometimes to get humor from a play, because a lot of it is in the cadence, it's in the rhythm, it's in the timing. And, you know, when you're writing dialogue in a play, then you want to really come across just how funny something is. Sometimes you will do like an italicized something, or you will say a beat or whatever. But other times it's like you kind of just have to let actors and directors figure it out in rehearsal and find where the jokes are. And even then you go into previews and you have to wait to see where the audience finds the humor.
It's so tricky and it's so tenuous and it's so alive. Like, I've watched so many plays where just different jokes will hit different nights, and God only knows why, what's in the air, why this, why that. And you're so right that it changes the whole process, because actors will find jokes that you never even could see in your text that are fully written there, and then suddenly that's a joke, and your very funny joke is feels very serious now and meaningful. But I'll tell you, that's plays for you, and that's why it's great, a play like this, which has both anyway.
Well, also, it's, there's a there's a maturity to the comedy, to the stage comedy that happens really starting with Neil Simon, not with the beginning of Neil Simon's career, but rather like Neil Simon found the key that would allow the theatrical comedy to become much more human. I don't think he personally perfected it, but he definitely like, so we have Barefoot in the Park and Odd Couple, which are these plays about people. And a lot of the comedy comes from just their personalities and the things that they do. But he also was a joke machine, and he was very famous for knowing that a line would get a laugh. And if it was being rehearsed improperly, he'd be like, no, you got to say it like this. Otherwise it will not get a laugh. And then starting with Plaza Suite, which I don't know how familiar you are with Plaza Suite.
Only just.
I did see the SJP Matthew Broderick revival, which was fine, but I enjoyed myself way more than I thought I would.
Right.
But the first act isn't terribly funny. The next two are much more classic Neil Simon. The first act is more of a dramedy of a married couple, like 20 years into marriage or whatever, and on their sort of semi-second honeymoon at the Plaza. And it's sad because the spark is kind of gone, but no, the wife is trying to relive the magic of their wedding night, and he's distant and definitely having an affair. And there are jokes, you know, they both make wisecracks, but there is a sadness to it, and the jokes do not come from like bada bing bada boom. It's out of the situation. There is a human reason why they are both trying to crack wise, because they are trying to break the tension and ease up with each other. That is sort of the beginning of that kind of style of comedy. Because other than that, we have Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, where the comedy is just vicious.
Oh my god! Yeah, I have to be in the right mood to enjoy Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Well, because like are you familiar with the play The Women?
Yes.
You gave me the kind of look that has, like, I asked you, have you ever saved a baby from a burning building? Like, why would I not save a baby from a burning building? No,
it was quite the contrary. In fact, it was like, oh, I sort of forgot that existed. And now I'm like, do I know it? Is it the thing that I'm thinking of? But now
the women means a lot more to gay men than it means to actual women. But that play is so very funny because it's all just one-liners, it's jabs. And Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is that times 10. Whereas The Women, it's always like a little bit of a stigma. It's like, oops, I pricked you accidentally with my pin. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf takes a dagger, slices your arm open and goes, whoops.
Yeah.
And then pours, and then pours scotch in the wounds. Yeah, while making eye contact and pouring scotch in the wounds. But after Plaza Suite, we start getting these comedies in the 70s that are veering away from like the Boeing, like, hey baby, like everything's sexy and swinging, and their comedies are much more about people. And then in the 80s we get Biloxi Blues and Broadway Bound and now Heidi Chronicles, where it's still very funny, but the humor comes less from like, oh my god, can you believe the wit of that one-liner, and more like the it's funny because it's true, I recognize that.
Yes, so true. And it's like sometimes it's just charming. I just was lucky enough to see the Merrily We Roll Along at New York Theater.
I saw that.
Okay, very lucky duck with my own gay best friend, my own Peter Patrone, who bought me that ticket for my birthday. But one of the most charming things about it, I felt, was the playfulness between friends. And you get so much of that true, genuine playfulness in this piece. Like, speaking of Peter Patrone, one of my favorite scenes, of course, is when he comes out to her and they do this bit where she's just hitting him, like he takes her hands and he hits himself with her hands.
Yeah,
and says, yes, that's for me being selfish and not saying and for all these things. And she hits him later and she says, I'm hitting you for not being hopelessly in love with me for all this time. And it's not like it's funny, but it's so like it's charming, because of course, like, this scene they're learning about each other, and she is a little bit heartbroken because she always thought maybe he was like her safety guy or like her backup marriage. But also she's like, and I want to meet Stanley, and, you know, and it's like the beginning of something very true and beautiful. And it's so charming, I feel like, to watch friends do friend things. And sometimes you get that with her relationship with Susan, which of course then like sort of ends up the opposite way, mm-hmm. where she has that really unfortunate scene with Susan at the end where she's trying to like pitch her a movie pilot or like a TV show to work on, as opposed to Peter, who ultimately she stays for, like,
yeah.
she That's one of my favorite scenes, also my second favorite scene after.
That might be one of the most, I forgot about that scene, and reading it last night before this episode, I was like, oh, how come we don't have more of these scenes?
More of these, please.
We have so many works. So, okay. Oh, God. And I need to not talk about this too in depth, because this is such a major theme in Significant Other. Mm. The friendship between a straight woman and a gay man is really hard, because especially when they meet when they're both single, right? Because eventually their lives go from parallel to perpendicular, and society tends to favor the norm, the hetero norm. So like, yeah, more likely is that she will get married, she will have babies, and it just gets harder and harder to maintain the friendship. And you watch them try to be there for each other, but it just gets more difficult. And ultimately, in now that we're all sort of in the mind frame of like, I have to protect me, I have to do what's good for me, it's like any bending you do for another is considered weak. But if you care about someone and they really need something from you, wouldn't you try to bend a little bit to help them? And usually that's talked about as like, well, the person you're married to, right? Or you're committed to. And it's like, well, what about the person who has been there for you the majority of your life? Can't you give them a little bit? And I think what makes it work in Heidi Chronicles is he's the one who's now in a relationship and she is not. So she can, but she does ultimately change. She reverses a life-altering decision because he asks her to, because he really needs her.
And it's like the value you put on that, because I completely agree with everything you've said. And I even think it's something that you see beyond that. Like I mentioned my gay best friend, and I am a lesbian, so I'm not a straight woman destined for marriage and children, thank God, because I don't want those things, but very scary. But you know, there's this feeling I feel like with a close friendship and somebody who means so much to you still, that you're trying to build a life outside of that. And yeah, friends are great and they can help you, but you're not like building your life around them. And sometimes I think it's worth stopping to think, well, but why? Like sometimes that's your fucking person, and you can make a decision because they bring joy to your everyday. It's not worth less because you're not fucking. Like, it's just, can I say that on your podcast? I forgot.
I've said it like 9 times already.
Okay. Fuck, fuck, fuck.
Yeah.
But you know,
this is not your third time on the podcast, Jesse.
I have like such a bad memory for everything. You'll learn about all my flaws, Matt, as we become close over time. And one day you'll ask me to stay for you, and I'll say, yeah, okay, sure.
And I will say in response, fuck, shit, piss. And here we are.
We will cry and hug and listen to little records and sing songs that we sang 40 years ago, like the Shoop Shoop song.
I'm so glad.
It's all relevant to the Heidi Chronicles.
It's all in the play. It's all in the plot.
And I just love the emphasis that they put on that friendship, which is, you know, like the first scene is not Scoop, it's Peter. And the first time I read the play, I was like, okay, so I guess that first scene was just like, psych, it's not him, it's him.
Yeah.
But it's like, actually, isn't that the more meaningful relationship? One could argue it's not, but sometimes I argue it is.
I think it is the most meaningful in that one. It's a shame that Peter doesn't get the last scene with Heidi.
Yeah.
But in a way, I don't know, like the final scene with Scoop where he talks about like his midlife crisis and, oh, this change of heart. So he sold his very successful magazine because, you know, yes, he made money. Yes, he had some cultural influence, but ultimately it doesn't mean anything. And then it turns out it's all bullshit anyway. He's going to run for, what, like Congress or something like that? Yeah. And so even though, you know, he and Heidi now have a friendship that... Heidi's friendship with Scoop in the end, because it starts off as a toxic semi-romance.
Yeah, building up to the end of Act 1, which we haven't even talked about yet. The fucking wedding scene is crazy.
Oh yeah, that wedding scene, I would argue, is sort of like perhaps the thesis of the play, because nothing is really left answered in that scene. So that's really where the thesis is, I would argue, than anything else. But they go from toxic romance to sort of a toxic friendship, and then his life. Even though he finds success and checks off all the boxes, they both get progressively less happy, but she is not so full of shit that she's actually willing to try to get happy. He's too full of shit to ever know what it is to be happy probably ever again. And yeah. They have that final scene where he claims to have this big epiphany. It turns out it's all bullshit. And it's sort of like not the final nail in the coffin, but it allows her to get less tied to him. Because even if he's not her partner, even if he's not her husband, even if they don't have sex anymore, he's still a little too toxically involved in her life, in my opinion.
For sure. No, he keeps showing back up, and it says more about him at some point than it does about her.
Yeah.
He's drawn here that there's something about her that makes him feel some sort of way when he's the one who, God, in that scene, you know, he's like, I can't marry a 10. I can't marry an A+ because we'd always be competing.
Yeah.
Like, I need somebody who's going to just support.
Yeah. And there's always just going to be disappointment. So we can talk about the wedding scene now. First of all, something to know about Scoop. The lone straight man in the play. Obviously, you know, we have talked about this a bit already. When he and Heidi meet at this event for canvassing for this political candidate, they begin this toxic romance that goes over about like 2 or 3 years. And then we flash forward like another 4 years, maybe, or maybe not even that long.
Get a little... They list it all so nicely at the top of the play.
They do. Because after the women's meeting, then it's the museum where Peter comes out. Or not comes out, but he's already out, but sort of tells Heidi, like, hey, update. I'm gay. I've been gay. And I've been living a very good life as a gay.
Yes.
Just thought you should know.
And she goes, what?
Hers are what? So... The women's meeting is 1970. 1974 is when Peter meets her in Chicago and he's like, gay. I am the first gay. Oh. And I think she and Scoop are still kind of connected in that way, right? And then we flash forward to 1977. So 3 years later, and we are at Scoop's wedding in New York.
We're at his wedding. We are at it.
He just got married.
I'm like, just to even realize where you are after that jump, you're like, oh, shit. And Heidi came and you're like, why would this happen?
Yeah, why would Heidi go? And listen, 3 years is a long time. There's a lot of heartbreak and baggage and healing that probably happened. She claims that she came because Peter wanted to go.
Yeah.
Peter wanted to meet Scoop, which also tells you something about Heidi and Scoop, about their relationship, that Peter has never met him until this point.
Yep. Sure does.
And granted, you know, this is pre-cell phones, pre-Skype, so it's all about phone calls and letters, no emails yet, or like taking a plane, because for a while they're all living in different cities. New York, Peter's in New York, Heidi was in Chicago for a long time, but yeah, like there was no meeting. Peter wanted to go to the wedding, which I love. It's sort of like a bit of a... It's definitely a neg towards Scoop, where Peter's like, I had to see this for myself.
Yeah, for sure. No, and everyone's there. Susan's there because she has some sort of connection. They served in the same internship or something in the...
Yeah, they're all there for, you know, different...
There at this insane wedding where Scoop, like the worst man in the world, says something insane when Peter's like, so are you in love? Because you know, when I see two people of your age getting married, I should hope you're in love. And he says, am I in love? Sure, why not? He says, like, what a monster. what a horrible... He's fine. But I believe that he's real is the thing of it. But that's an insane line to me to say at your own wedding. And it's also insane to spend so much time talking to your ex-lover.
Well, and so Scoop, one of his characteristics in his speech, something that he drops in Act Two as we get further down the road, and it gets brought up more sort of jokingly because it's like a shorthand for all of them, is he rates everything. 1 to 10, F to A. So-and-so. A+ conversation, B- looks. he doesn't really rate women on letter grades. He rates them by numbers and not by physicality, but just sort of like their potential.
Yeah.
And he calls Heidi a 10 woman, not because like she's a supermodel, but because she is so intelligent, she's so funny, she is gonna do so much, and she's got ambition, she's gonna challenge him. Yeah, and as you said, he doesn't want to come home to a 10, he wants to come home to a 6. And what I think is so great about the play is he marries a woman named Lisa, and I love that Wendy gives her a little dignity. Yes, and she doesn't does. Doesn't make her the worst. Mm-hmm. She's kind. Mm-hmm. She's we don't get a lot of, we don't see a lot of her intelligence, but we're led to believe she's not a total dum-dum. And
she's an illustrator.
She's a successful illustrator.
And the vibe is like, and now we will put that away so she can be married to Scoop.
Yeah. Well, I love that there's because we there's an about face that Peter has when he meets Lisa, because she's from the South and blah blah blah. And so all immediately he's like, oh, this dum-dum, especially like, oh, she agreed to marry this piece of shit. What kind of idiot are we dealing with? And when it's revealed that she illustrates these children's books, essentially, and then one apparently had to do with like a hospital and human anatomy, and Peter's now a doctor, he's blown away because he thinks those books are genius.
Yeah.
And so now his only issue with Lisa is, why did you marry him?
Yeah. No, it's kind of, you're so right about that. Wendy does a great job of not making us like hate Lisa. In fact, yeah. We like Lisa, and I feel terrible for Lisa, because in some ways you always want your protagonist to like get the guy, I guess. But watching Lisa be married to Scoop, you're just sort of relieved that Heidi's not in that position, even though of course she wanted it.
Yeah, and she wanted it in many ways. A, because she and Scoop have this connection that can't be undone, unfortunately.
Certainly love is there. Doesn't mean it's healthy, but there is love.
There is love, yeah. Not healthy love, but love. And many of us do want a person beside us. It helps to have that kind of companionship. And there are so many things in life that you want to share with somebody. And I think sort of in the back of her brain might have had a fantasy that Scoop could eventually resolve enough of his issues that when they fought, it would be healthy fighting, not like hit my head against the wall kind of fighting.
Absolutely.
And yeah. And we see glimpses into their marriage in Act 2 as you go down the road, and we just see how unhappy they both are. Scoop starts cheating. Lisa clearly knows he's cheating. He's cheating on her during her baby shower. Like, they're about to have...
Everyone knows. Like, everyone ran knows. Into him with this woman. Like, it's not even being kept a secret, because he doesn't need to keep it a secret. He's Scoop fucking Rosenbaum.
Exactly. And so Wendy makes us care about Lisa, because Lisa's not a bad person. She's a relatively intelligent person. She's a kind person. She's not the most interesting, which I think is also good, because it gives us a realistic understanding of why someone would marry Scoop. Like, oh, she's smart. She's not that smart. She's nice. She's not that nice. And it's like, yeah.
That, back to that thing too of like, women had to marry. Everyone is like looking to marry. And you wonder, I wonder for Heidi, like, if Peter wasn't gay, would she have just married him, regardless of like if she really loved him or not? At some point, are you like, I want children, I want someone, I want to succeed at this thing we all have to succeed at? You know, there's a scarcity mindset out there. And if Scoop Rosenbaum is turning on the charm and telling you he wants to marry you, being his charismatic, although a creep, as Heidi admits, but a charismatic creep, and Fran iconically says, I fucking hate charisma. Because it's true, it works. I believe that you could get swept off your feet and make a big mistake. But there's something about, especially for the poor straights out there, I'll tell you, Matt, I feel terrible for them every day. They just are drawn into this trap of marriage because it feels like the ultimate modicum of success. And it feels like once you achieve that, then happiness lies beyond. Although often it's the opposite. Women become very depressed after their weddings a lot of the time, because that's like the thing they looked forward to since they were children. And now what do they look forward to? The sweet embrace of death? I don't know.
People also will look at marriage as a payment of the investment they put into this relationship. It's like all the time I put into you has officially led to the profit of a marriage. Like, it was worth it in the end, was it not? We got the married.
And now you're trapped in the married, and I hope it was worth it.
Yeah, well, because so many people don't view marriage as just rather than asking themselves, like, does this feel right? Does the idea of being married to you really give me happiness? Or is it just that that's what I am supposed to do, and I have to justify all the time I've spent on you? Yeah. I think what's also interesting, though, we talk about, like, would she have married Peter and the Scoop charm. It's good that we see other female characters where Scoop's charm does not work. Yes. Susan hates him.
Oh, my God.
His charm does not work on her. There's another woman at the wedding who I forget her name, but she's there and, like, Scoop does not work on her either. So it's not like he's irresistible to everyone. Just, you know, rather we see two women who it's worked on and how that goes for them. But also, it's not as if Heidi is celibate outside of Scoop. We keep hearing about these relationships she's in. And
Mostly with editors. She's dating all the time.
Yeah, she's seeing men. She's putting herself out there. We could argue how much of herself she's putting into dating them. If they all seem to follow the same criteria and it keeps not working, it's like, well, are you biding your time till Scoop comes in? Or are you biding your time till Peter just wants to commit to you? Or are you just sort of passing through until the next guy or the next job? Or is this really one of your blind spots as an intelligent woman? You can see so much of the world. And this is the one thing about yourself you really can't understand is a pattern that you need to break. And she says to herself when she's talking about Scoop in the women's meeting, she's like, the way I am acting, the situation I am in, if I saw a girlfriend in it, it would be so clear cut to me. I'm like, run for the fucking hills. She's like, but there's something about when you're in it and there are things about the heart and the brain that you can't connect sometimes, like you stay way longer than you should. boy, do I know it.
Oh my God, we all know it.
Uh-huh.
And it's so easy to know what our friends should do. And then it's so hard to know what we should do. And they, of course, are in the same position. I know exactly what all my friends should do, and none of them are doing it. And I can't blame them because I've never once taken their romantic advice.
Exactly.
And I never will, because you simply have to live through some things and decide for yourself. And being on the inside of something is very different from looking at it clearly from a vantage point.
Yeah. There was a time when I would talk to a friend of mine about a person I was around, and I would sort of repeat some of our conversation to them. And the conversations when we had them, I was like, oh my God, like, this is really lovely. We're connecting this gorgeous way. And I would repeat it to my friend and they'd be like, this is a mess. And I'm like, my response would always be, okay, I'm clearly not capturing to you what this conversation was if you keep on thinking it's a mess. And they're like, no, you're not hearing this without this person's face attached. You need to hear what the words are away from that. And it took a long time, but eventually it's like, oh yeah, no, that wasn't great. That was nice, but that part wasn't great.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well put. And I would almost share a personal story myself, but actually I won't,
I shared a little bit of my personal life in the Torch Song Trilogy episode, which is honestly what I'm referring to right now. Don't you worry, y'all. You'll learn more details of that when my own play is finished.
Yes, exactly. You'll have to buy a ticket to my personal life. I'm so sorry, but it's very interesting. And
the working title is No One Tells You When You've Been Handed a Stick of Dynamite Till It Blows Up in Your Face.
A little long, Matt, but very good.
The working title. And brought to you by my therapist from BetterHelp. This podcast is brought to you by BetterHelp. Actually, that reminds me, we should take a quick break.
Billy, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. Mm-hmm. You're the top.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSMusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
We're back.
Wow, what a great break. I feel refreshed, Matt. Do you feel refreshed?
I feel so refreshed. Let's talk more about feminism. So
I would love to. Welcome. Nobody says that to me every minute of my life.
Jesse, can I tell you something about feminism?
Yes, explain it to me.
I'm going to explain it so clearly because as a man, and I use that in quotation marks.
Only you can know what it means.
Listen, I do not subscribe to the theory that the attributes we have put towards masculinity means you are a man.
Absolutely true.
That said, I am currently pantsless, wearing a Kimberly Akimbo sweatshirt, sitting next to my Paddington Bear doll. Before I go to the gym and work out to the Rock of Ages soundtrack. How much of a man am I? I'm all man, baby.
That is right.
So as the most man, let me explain something to your woman brain.
Please try, but it's hard. It's only a woman.
That's what she said. Honestly, I have nowhere to go with this. I kept trying. I just really wanted to set the most misogynistic scene.
I know, we had to do the bit. It's very important to do the bit.
Well, I was honestly... It was a bit of a game of chicken. I was like, how far can I go until Jesse just goes, and we're done.
I go really far. So.
And see, I'm vegan. Oh, God, I wish I was vegan. My life would be so much easier.
Listen, I can't because I'm gluten-free, so I can't do both or I won't eat anything.
No.
Yeah, because I'm not high maintenance. I have a disease. Anyway, tell me about feminism.
Well, so that's, you actually would like the restaurant that I used to work at, the Little Beet Table. It was a gluten-free, gluten-free restaurant. And then people would come thinking that we were just like specialty dietary restrictions, which we eventually were. But we were like, no, we have everything else. The reason why we are gluten-free is because there are so many celiacs out there who can't go anywhere.
Celiacs represent.
Celiacs should be able to eat a hamburger. And not about the bun.
What a sort of like bold thing to say to me. What a sweet, empowering thing.
What? That you should not have to worry about a hamburger?
Yeah.
Yes. As a feminist celiac, you should be able to eat a hamburger and not worry about the bun.
That's gorgeous, Matt. That's a better world out there one day.
That's going to be the new working title for my play.
That's even better.
Even longer, too. And far more specific about something that my play is not about.
In for a penny, in for a pound, I say.
Penny for a pound.
Feminism.
What was it? The Susan character, by the way.
Yes.
Susan, I think, Wasserstein in this play, she shows us all these different ways in which women succeed. We see women get jobs and get to the top of their field. We see women who get to have successful careers and have families, women who just do the family route, women who are relatively confident and competent, but maybe lose a bit of themselves, women who are lost their happiness. The scene with Susan at the lunch table with Heidi in Act 2 is funny just in terms of how much it eviscerates the LA person.
Yes.
But it is devastating when you see the friend that Heidi has lost.
Yeah.
And the friend is unaware that she is so far gone.
Completely unaware. In fact, probably from Susan's perspective, she thinks she's being so nice to even like think of Heidi and sort of bring a piece of her success to her old friend. But Heidi just wants to talk to her.
Yeah. Heidi's like, I wanted to catch up. And Susan's like, yeah, we are catching up. No one eats at lunch. And yeah, it's like it's been a while since they've seen each other. And as you said, like Susan is pitching Heidi a TV sitcom based off of her book, which isn't even based off of her book. It's just, oh, we want to do like a thing about three female friends living in a loft. What if one of them is an artist? What if they're all in art in some way? One of them's a painter. One of them's a curator. One of them is like a researcher. And Heidi's like, is that interesting?
Heidi's like, what? And she's like, maybe you could be a consultant on it. And she's like, what? No.
Yeah.
What?
And she's like, if it's successful, it'll make you a lot of money. And she goes, you can help us figure out what makes these women funny. And she's like, I don't know what makes anyone funny.
I just sort of wanted to come here and talk to you about my life.
Yeah. And then Susan brings her associate who we knew back in the day, who's now...
It's like Lisa's sister or something.
Yeah, something like that. Like these two women who were in Heidi's life as friends, and now they're coming at her as businesswomen, and their success is not something that they should apologize for. But like any person in this world, you have to know when to turn it off and just be with the people who've been with you since, you know, the way back.
Yes, absolutely. And there's none of that. Instead, there's this very funny and insane bit about the swordfish.
With the butter, yeah.
Dry swordfish, no butter. And then she's like, I see butter on this. I can't eat butter. I told them no butter. Well, they didn't listen. Don't bring it back. I don't have any more time.
She's like, I'm just going to eat it. I don't have time. but she's not pleased. She complains that they haven't gotten their food yet, that they've been waiting forever. And then the waiter comes over and they order. And I'm like, then you never ordered, like, the food didn't come because you didn't order it.
Yeah. Susan's become kind of the worst. And it's a real shame because we've known her since, what, like, high school? I don't remember. And we love Susan. She's so funny and she changes so much over the course. She brings Heidi to that women's meeting. She's so mean to Scoop, which always feels amazing because Scoop sucks.
Yep. She's the one who brings up the Scoop situation at the meeting. She's like, Heidi's not going to bring it up, so I will.
Yeah, which, good friend, because she needed to talk about that. It was clearly therapeutic for Heidi. We end up in a great place. That's a great friend who's paying attention and who says things like, she'll drop anything for Scoop, even hanging out with me.
Yeah, and like, I've known her since childhood. Although, in Heidi's defense, Susan did drop everything at that dance to go dance with Twist and Smoke Boy.
She sure did. And Twist and Smoke is so funny that he can twist and smoke at the same time.
So what else can he do at the same time?
Hey, I bet she found out.
Both fingers, baby.
Oh my gosh. I'm blushing over here. My goodness. Yeah, yes, but you're right.
I find that offensive to people with rosacea, okay?
Listen. The thing is that Susan is so many things. It's just the thing about Wendy Wasserstein that I love is I just believe her. Susan is so many amazing things, and sometimes she fucking sucks. And then her last scene, she's the worst person in the world. And I'd like to think that maybe in 15 more years, they'll meet again and something else will change, but maybe not. I mean, the interesting thing is that the play ends when Heidi's what, like 40, and she has a child. And of course, Wendy Wasserstein famously had a child at in her 40s. I think she was 48 or 49. Yeah,
48, 49.
She dies like 6 years later. She dies, I think, at the age of 55. Or maybe I'm mixing up the fives. But
you're correct. This is all correct, Jesse.
Coincidence, but... And it's just crazy to think, because I would like to think about what happens in the sequel to the Heidi Chronicles, More Chronicles, Harder, Part 2.
The Heidi Chronicles of Narnia.
Yes, exactly. Take me back through the wardrobe to see like what happens in another 10, 15 years. And Wendy Wasserstein never gets that, ironically. She doesn't see her daughter grow up. Her daughter now is only 23. I looked it up last night because I was like, what happened to that kid? Was raised by her brother after she died, and then her brother's family after he died. The Wassersteins are not a well clan, but it's, what was my point here? It's just fascinating. What she really captures is how people change, and it's, you really feel like you've known them since back then, because the scenes are so heady and believable and full of specific crumbs that really draw you in. And I felt a real loss with Susan. It was a real bummer. And the only antidote for that was the scene with Peter, which is like just the opposite. But
yeah. Well, no one in this play is perfect, right? Like there's the scene where Heidi, Scoop, and Peter all come on the morning
talk show. Oh my God.
And Scoop and Peter just talk over Heidi the entire time.
Both just talk over her the whole time. Even the reporters keeps trying to reach out to Heidi and they just keep answering every question.
Yep.
Unbearable and accurate.
Peter does not Peter does not answer for Heidi, whereas Scoop does. At least I don't think so. If I recall, Peter's biggest fault for talking so much is anytime something is said that he thinks needs to be corrected, like the whole how old a woman can be to bear children. He's like, it's very important to him, like, make sure the world knows. Yeah, as a doctor, I need you to know. And then anytime he's thinking Scoop's just being a dick, he's like, I have to respond to that. He might talk over Heidi a couple times as well.
I think he does. They both definitely interrupt her at the very least.
Yeah. And Heidi, as a character, I don't find any moments in the play where Heidi's like necessarily doing anything bad to others. She can be a little selfish and a little obtuse.
Yes.
And like not be
after
aware
herself,
that
I would say.
You know what?
treating herself badly.
Yeah, she's not always great to herself, but she's not necessarily terrible to others. And I think that's partly because, you know, she is sort of a visitor in her own life and in her own generation. She's observing everything and not being as fully a part of any of it as she could. And so there's also something to be said about like how her friendships kind of go in and out because of it. Like if you're not committing to something, how are you supposed to like expect anyone to commit back to you?
Yeah, it's true. And it's like that way, I think that you sometimes like give up agency in your own life. And then by the end, she reclaims it. But you're right that she doesn't really do anything bad to anybody because she doesn't really do a lot of anything to anybody. The worst thing maybe she does is give that insane speech at her alma mater.
Yeah, where she talks about the aerobics class.
Yeah, about the aerobics class. Great, insane monologue. Really unhinged. I love it a lot.
Yeah. What I like about that monologue is like, she doesn't say anything that's so prophetic.
Yeah.
What she ultimately concludes is something that, you know, always needs to be said. We shouldn't compare ourselves, right? And like, yeah, all that, but she's not giving this like, here's the truth, ladies, and you're all gonna walk out changed today. She gives a speech that's sort of like, it's not the worst speech in the world, because like it's an entertaining story, but you're also like, where's this going? Okay, and then they're like, oh god, is this woman unraveling before my eyes? Okay, well, she doesn't completely fall apart, but also like she's not completely together at the same time. Okay.
Yeah, it's really twisty, because at first it seems like she's giving a great speech that's going to have an enormous payoff, and it sort of just keeps winding off the road and off the road until it's just like a woman asking why she still feels alone and stranded when she is supposed to feel liberated and like a part of something bigger than her, but she just feels alone. And again, she's asking like she asked Fran, she's asking this room like, why? I thought we were in this together. Why do I feel alone? And then it's just over. You know, she leaves. I can't imagine what the room is like that she walks out of at that point. Awkward speech. But well,
the event is also called Women, Where Are We Going? So
where are we going?
In a way, her speech is apropos.
So apropos. Where are we going, Heidi?
Yeah, where are we going with the speech, Heidi? And then she's also kind of saying like, where have I gone to? I don't know where I am, and I don't know what's next. And I feel like everyone has abandoned me, but also no one knows where they're going yet. Also keep saying they do. Like, what is any of this?
What is any of this? Great questions from Heidi.
Heidi asks the really specific questions. What is any of this?
What is any of this? And we all go, you know what, Heidi? I don't know either.
No. Life is not like a painting.
No, it sure isn't. It sure isn't. It's just great. And it's such a funny speech. And then it's just like the details of it all. That Wendy Wasserstein is so funny. The way that the aerobics instructor is called Jeanette. Like,
yeah.
That's
funny. Yeah, I mean, she talks about all the different types of women in the locker room and how like the power businesswomen come in with their own heavier weights. And
their own heavier weights from home.
Yeah, all this stuff. It's just, yeah, I don't know. Like, there's so much comedy to be had from just human observation, but that also does provide a great deal of isolation.
For sure. And you feel the amount of detail that Heidi has about this locker room experience with all these women, you know that she's an observer of her own life, just as certainly Wendy Wasserstein is in some ways or in all ways, as all playwrights, I suppose, on some level must be.
All good playwrights, anyway.
All good playwrights.
Yeah.
Looking at the world and being able to synthesize it into something real. But Heidi really was like paying attention. There's so many details to this. And of course, that makes sense. She's an art historian. She looks at paintings. She tells us all about them. She's got great insights on it. But at the end of the day, you can't just look at something from the outside. You have to make choices from the inside. And that's why it's so lovely that we end with just her and her daughter that she chose as like a big decision, a big liberated, as it were, decision.
Yeah.
Just if she wants a daughter, go get one. Go to the store. One daughter, please. What's the going rate on that? $5? I don't know.
What's interesting is that Wendy Wasserstein talked about when the play came out, the ending was actually kind of controversial for a lot of women.
Not surprised to hear it.
Yeah. Well, because they all thought that the play was ultimately saying, once you have a child, you'll finally be happy. And Wendy's like, no. Heidi's now happier because she's figuring out what it is that she wants and doing it in her own way. Like, Heidi is a specific... It's why I really hate how we as progressive thinking audiences now, any story that is told about a group that is not straight white men, that character has to represent the entire community.
It's such a big nightmare. And especially back then when it's like these early stories that were so rare to see. I mean, they're still rare to see, honestly. Mm-hmm. You do bear the burden of needing to be like the perfect, the ideal minority. And everything you say ripples out as the only choice for everyone. When certainly what this play is talking about is just picking the thing that is going to actually make you happy. And it doesn't really matter what that thing is. And if she picked job, I think a different group of women would feel equally disappointed in that. But she can't pick everything.
Yeah.
Picks the thing that's true, and certainly the thing that's true for, I think, Wendy Wasserstein, who had a child in her 40s, never revealed who the father was or what happened, but
really predicted her own future. Wendy had her child through childbirth. She didn't adopt, whereas Heidi adopted. But yeah, it doesn't matter what road Heidi would choose at the end of the play. Someone would have an issue with it. The only sort of saving grace when it comes to these reactions is, like, usually it takes about 2 years after the thing comes out, and then the community is like, okay, we can recognize how it's good, because people will now look at it as part of the whole tapestry of works. So, like, for example, when, like, Call Me By Your Name came out, people who loved it, and then people who were like, this doesn't represent my story. And then after like 3 years, we're like, oh, well, when you put it alongside the 50 other stories that have come out in the last 15 years, it's just a really well done one in the tapestry. I'm like, yeah, can we not think of that the moment it comes out? And
truly, everybody get with it. But that is exactly why we need such a broad tapestry of diverse storytelling that covers so many stories, so that we have art that resonates with everybody.
Yeah.
And it was so rare. I mean, God, if there's a point beaten over our head in this play, it's like, there are not that many women artists, and so we must talk about them. And that's certainly true for playwrights. I mean, I was told to read Wendy Wasserstein because she is a woman playwright and I am a woman playwright. And there is like resentment to that. Like, what do we share? And then of course it's like everything actually, but
yeah,
you know,
well, you're not required to like her. You're not required to even think she's very good.
But I do both. I like
her. And we're very glad for it. Well, because I agree. I think she is a very good playwright. Do I think everything she wrote was great? No, but I also don't think everything Tennessee Williams wrote was great. Anyone who tells you that Camino Royale or whatever it's called is good is fucking lying to you. That play is a mess. But, you know, there is sort of like a kinship and a support you want to have. It's like, well, as, you know, as a queer person and creative, like, I do want to support all the queer works that come out. That doesn't mean I'm required to like them. I can give honest feedback and constructive criticism on it in hopes that someone who's wanting to make queer works in the future can make something even better. I am definitely of the mind frame that the most universal stories are the most specific ones, the ones that do not preach and rather just give you insight into something. Like, it's like a snapshot into someone's world, and that is what Heidi Chronicles is. You know, it's not there, and there are conversations where people talk about, like, the overall idea of feminism and what does it mean to be woman, but again, Wendy Wasserstein is so good at comedy that it goes down easy, and she gives you scenes in which those conversations make sense. God damn, did you see the new 1776?
I sure did, Matt.
Do you recall, in Act Dos, right as they're about to sign La Constitution, and Adams is all like, it's not perfect. Oh, no. What can we do? And Franklin looks at Adams and goes, "How? You know, what can we do? we're nothing, we're just men. And they all, everyone starts slowly looking out to the audience. We are all just men. And hopefully history will remember that when they think of us. And then they go back. Or like there's another.
That was like the worst moment of my life is when they looked at us.
Fucking hated it. There's another moment where like Abigail Adams does something that I know for sure is something that they added to the script where she like walks on stage. She's like, it comes from a letter Abigail Adams actually wrote to John Adams about do not forget the women, but they definitely tweak it a bit where she's like, and everyone knows how amazing women are and we should not be forgotten or ignored because one day we will inherit everything. And she like does it on a bevel and like looks out to the mezzanine and she's like, I'm not preaching, but however, I am extending my arm as I say all of this. And I'm like, can you not piss on my leg and tell me it's raining?
I know. Well, that's the thing about the whole thing. I'll try not to get too derailed by this, although I'd love to. But it's like,
think of where you're at, Jesse. You're on Broadway Breakdown. Get derailed. Do the tangent.
Let me simply say, when you're trying to force meaning upon a text that was never meant to say any of the things you're trying to say, I guess I get that when any line seems vaguely related to the thing that you're trying to shove in here, you want to point at it really hard. But like, God, that text did not support whatever they were trying to do. And frankly, like, to be perfectly honest, I'm never going to forgive them for not letting Thomas Jefferson kiss his wife. Why didn't they kiss, Matt? Why didn't they kiss? The whole plot is that you can't write the Declaration until they fuck, and they're not going to kiss. There's a line that says, look how they fit together. They're just like slow dancing. Is it because they're both women? Because I'll never forgive them if that's the case.
I'll also never forgive them for not allowing Martha Jefferson to want to fuck her husband. Rather, they gave her the attitude of when they're like, well, we sent for her, and then she gives them a look. I'm like, bitch, you got the letter. What did you think you were coming up for, to write the declaration?
And I have this horrible question. Why are they like diluting that? There's no queerness in the piece at all for a cast that is very visibly queer.
They are taking away a woman's autonomy to enjoy her sexuality.
Yeah.
By underlining how much Martha is insulted that she's there as basically a fleshlight. I'm like, no, she wants to fuck her husband too.
Yes.
She's been horny this entire time too.
And for once, the text is supporting something interesting about women's sexuality, and now you're going to fight the text. Like, it's just...
And then they make the second half of He Plays the Violin a mental breakdown.
I had no idea what was happening.
So fucking
I will say, like, the minute that the curtain went up and I saw that cast on stage, like, something, like, it was like, I felt deeply emotional about that. And then I just wish that they were doing any other play in the world.
Yeah, listen, I like 1776. I think it is objectively a well-written piece.
That said,
I am not so, like, devoted to it that I'm like, how dare you alter any of the ticks? How dare you do it with women? Like, the idea of a non-cisgender male cast, I'm like, cool, let's see what happens. And then
in many ways, it is the most I ever enjoyed myself at 1776. And in other ways, part of that was because I kept going, oh, but, you know, like, I grew up in 1776, and I loved, like, the new orchestrations, and, like, it was very, and it was just fun to see. I just love watching women do anything, or femme people do anything.
God, I really hope one of the ad breaks for this isn't still 1776.
Which is pretty funny.
Because it used to be. We used to have ad breaks for that show, but I think we're past that part, that one. I think that was just for the beginning of November. I'm hoping for the second half of December. We'll see. But, yeah, God. I'm really trying not to piss too hard on that production because it'll be closed soon enough. But like,
I love if you're going to do an adaptation, like a revival, please do it new. I want that. I love that.
Yeah.
I still will have problems with it if I have problems with it.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean I'm not glad they did it, you know, on some level.
They tried something. I think what it is, though, connecting it to Heidi Chronicles in a way, is it didn't feel like anybody really explored the nuances. They were much more interested in the immediate gratification of a liberal-based subscriber audience cheering on any little notion of feminism they could sort of shimmy their shoulders to, instead of really digging deep into the complexity of it all, similar to the queer element, this being sexually driven, and exploring that, being having more masculine traits, feminine traits, whatever the fuck those things mean.
Absolutely.
Right. And then with Heidi Chronicles, it's sort of, you know, we see different women have very specific ideas of what it means to be a feminist, what it means to be successful as a woman. And Heidi's just constantly confused because she's like, but she's like, what then? What am I? And if you think it's this and you think it's that, are you both wrong? Are you both right? What, like, what is, and all she wants are answers. And unfortunately, in life, we don't get many answers.
You just have to choose them for yourself, you know?
Which and is, that is feminism.
There it is. And you get to pick what feminism is. Feminism could literally be marrying a husband and quitting your job and raising a family at home. That's feminism if that's what the woman chooses.
This is what Charlotte York Goldenblatt spoke of in the season 4 episode, I think it's called Crime and Punishment. Yes. Where she tells Miranda when she's thinking of quitting her job so she and Trey could start a family, the women's movement is supposed to be about choice and I choose my choice.
Yes. And she's right.
I mean, she chose, she is right. She left her job at the nudging of Trey. And we don't love that. And also because she and Trey were not a good match. However, Charlotte did choose to get married to him after only knowing him for a month. She chose to get married to him after meeting fucking Bunny. So, but she learned from her mistake. She didn't realize she was handed a stick of dynamite, even though her friends tried to say.
I can tell her because it's very easy from that vantage point. But yeah. She picked the thing she truly believed would make her happy. Charlotte always wanted that sort of life, famously on Sex and the City. And
And she needed it to blow up in order for her to come down and realize how wonderful her life with Harry was. I very much enjoy that arc. It's a good arc on the show.
Good arc. It is. It is a good arc. And that's feminism, baby. Pick whatever you want. There's no rules and there's no wrong answers, as opposed to there being like everything is an answer. Find your own answer. Pick your own answer. And if it's right for you, it's right. I mean, the whole show, we're watching Heidi just be like she's such a sad girl, which I feel like is most girls, but not all girls, actually, but lots of sad girls out here who just feel sometimes like, you know, if it didn't work out in this way, or like something is wrong with me, that I'm like not meeting these benchmarks, that I'm not hitting these flags and I'm not succeeding, quote unquote, but there's no right way to live a life. It's just what works. And some people have it very easy. Maybe you'll meet your perfect person at the age of 15 and live a gorgeous life together. Or maybe you'll live a gorgeous life alone with lots of friends and or anything in between.
I think the important thing to remember always is that it starts with you.
Yes.
It always starts with you. You have, and I can't speak for you or anyone. I can definitely say for myself, a lot of times life is me distracting myself from sadness, and I will have sadness flare-ups that can get exacerbated by things and people, experiences and romances and jobs that just really fucking cut away at my soul, and you don't realize it immediately, but you eventually build yourself back up. And you have, in order for someone to be your anchor, you have to also be theirs. And in order to be that anchor, you gotta be strong, bitch.
Yes, you do. And that's very resonant, Matt. Certainly, if there's one sad girl in the world, sad girl TM, it's me. And I've been, you know, like,
hi, it's me. I'm the problem. It's me. Also, I'm gonna write that down. I like that. I like what I just said, but keep talking.
Please write it down. But I think that sometimes this is like a personal thing that I've been thinking about all month, which is that, like, how much do I conjure my own sadness? How much of it is it a fun part of my personality, and how much is it thrust upon me by a world that maybe rejects like fat queer women? Or, and how much of it am I doing to myself? Because at some point I decided that I don't deserve something, or I'm not allowed to be happy because I'm wrong in these ways. And it, like, I actually believe that we can put a measure of that down, mm-hmm. and just put it down and walk away from that and think, well, what, I'm certainly allowed to be happy, and maybe I just will be, and maybe I'll just move towards the things that make me happy, and maybe nothing was ever wrong and I haven't failed at anything, and just we're all different and everything is great, is sort of the month I'm having.
I love that. I'm sort of in the mind frame of failure is unavoidable, and you don't realize you're failing at something until you're pretty knee deep in it.
Yeah.
The important thing is to be able to walk away eventually and take some lessons from it.
Yeah.
because you're going to succeed again. Just because you failed today doesn't mean you're going to fail forever. And everything passes and you can change and people can change and you don't know what the future holds. I could not have told you the last 5 months of my life recently were going to be those 5 months. So I look forward to what the next 5 months are because they can only be wild.
Could not agree more. And same, Matt. I could not have predicted anything that's happened in my life. Not at all. And sometimes the surprises are horrible and sometimes they're so wonderful. And it's just like, just be in your life. I would say. Choose things, try things.
How can you take what you've been given and make it work for you? How do you, to quote Kimberly Akimbo?
Ah, great, please.
When life gives you lemons, you got to go out and steal some apples because who the fuck wants lemons?
Get your goddamn apples, everybody. And that's feminism.
And I think that's going to be our tagline for this episode. And that is feminism.
We solved it. We cracked feminism for you. It's apples.
I think the important thing to remember, though, is that, Jesse, you couldn't crack it until you talked to me. Yeah, a man,
famously. I agree. I was just actually going to say that thank God you were here because I didn't even know what feminism meant before today. And I can't read either. So it was very hard to become familiar with the Heidi Chronicles.
I had to have it read to me by my landlord, by my male landlord.
My landlord. Sorry, my landlord is a woman.
Sorry, what's a female bike? Do you mean, what's a girl bike? Do you mean like a female doctor? Get educated, Hitler.
Ba-da-ba.
It's one of my favorite 30 Rock jokes when Liz is on the mommy message boards and she's like, we're looking for a girl bike. She's 12. And they're like, what's a girl bike? Is that like a female doctor, you Hitler?
Yeah, well, what is a girl bike? I feel like they were made so women could bike in skirts and I'm like, surely we must be over that by now, but whatever.
I don't know. I'm also listening to the Office Ladies podcast with Jenna Fischer and Angela Kinsey, and they talk sometimes about certain things on the show. They're like, oh boy, but they did research and they found out that they never really clocked that women's pantsuits don't have pockets on them.
Okay,
and they always want to know that. And then they were like, well, let's figure out why that is. And it's, you know, there are misogynistic.
It's oppression, the lack of pockets. That's the worst oppression in our society. It's not the worst oppression, but it's a big problem and I hate it. And I famously love pockets and indeed have written several musical sequences about that.
About having pockets?
About how women should have pockets, yes.
I mean, there's famously a song called Pocket Full of Sunshine.
Very related, clearly about women and pockets and how we should have them. They're insane. Go look at women's pants. Go look at the pockets they give us. Sometimes they're not even pockets. Sometimes they sew a line into the pants so it looks like there's a pocket, but there's no pocket at all. And I think they're just trying to sell us handbags, but I want pockets to hold rocks that I find, as all women do.
Hold rocks.
All women just want pockets so they can hold rocks and frogs that they find on their nature walks. And I think that. Your wallet, God forbid. Your fucking.
And all I want is a Birkin, Jesse. Take my pockets. Give me your Birkin.
Done and done. I buy men's coats now because they're full of pockets. Do you know how many pockets you get? And did you know clothes have no gender actually? So I can just buy pockets.
Exactly. Exactly. What's a woman's pantsuit? Is that like a male? Male.
A mailman. I'll tell you, they sure don't have pockets, and everything should. And the moral of the Heidi Chronicles is please give women pockets. Thank you so much.
If women had pockets, Heidi would have cue cards for her speech at the Where Are Women Going seminar.
Might have gone a lot better.
That speech might have gone a lot better. I do love her. She's like, true to form, I did not write a speech. And that's where you're like, oh, fuck.
And then I'll tell you the only thing that Wendy Wasserstein ever says to me that I don't believe is when Heidi says, I didn't prepare anything. And then she tells that story. And I'm like, yes, you did. You came up with that on the fly. You said it so gorgeously, but it does descend into madness. I guess I could consider it as like Heidi's very, very smart, which she certainly is. But I'll tell you, it's a hell of a speech.
Yeah. It's, well, that's, that is the double-edged sword of being intelligent and articulate, is that people don't always realize what a mess you are, because you can express yourself so clearly.
Yes.
And it's like, just because I can say the right words doesn't mean what I'm feeling is any less fucked up.
Yep. It might be even more fucked up. And that's why they write the most interesting plays.
Mm-hmm. That's also, being a dramatic writer, similar to like any kind of artistic work, like acting, for example, I've mentioned this before, there's a little bit of having to be a sociopath.
Yeah.
You are capturing the human experience and then trying to package it in a way that can be palatable to the masses.
Yeah.
And, you know, actors have to tap into their mental well and their emotional well to recreate 8 times a week certain emotions and whatnot. And that requires some sociopathy. I don't know. But that's probably not the right word or pronunciation, but who the fuck cares? But
you know what I mean.
Yeah, you know what I mean. But there's also, I mean, there's a manipulation to that that, you know, is hard to sometimes draw a fine line of health and not toxicity and not have it bleed into your life. I don't know, maybe I'm projecting, but that is, but you know what I mean? Like you can be so smart and so creative, and you can see the bigger picture. And again, as a writer, you take what you know and you pick pieces from your life and see, and because you inherently understand like what might work in a dramatic story and put it in there. And someone who doesn't know you, who hasn't experienced any of it, can watch it and feel something. But then like someone from your life can clock certain things from it and go, I'm sorry. So were you actually upset that day when we spoke, or were you just sitting there pretending to be upset and mentally clocking everything I said so you could put it in your play?
Yeah. It gets very complicated. Life is art. And
yeah,
the lines blur and it can be hard to separate them. I often think, in stage directions, I feel, as I'm sort of observing the world around me, or sometimes I'll, you know, like script my own behavior such that I can, because I can, and sometimes that's easier to work off of a little script. But certainly regardless of how anyone presents, there's a deep inner life and often turmoil that cannot be ignored. And if you try to ignore it, Heidi, then you're just going to fuck up the speech and end it in a really weird place.
About your...
I feel stranded.
About your aerobics class feeling stranded. On that note, let's take one more break.
Really, I beg to differ with you.
How do you mean?
You're the top.
Yeah.
You're an arrow collar. You're the top.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back.
Wow. Each break is more refreshing than the last, Matt.
I'm becoming more of a feminist by each break.
I learned how to read over the last break.
And I learned how not to.
And now we're going to switch.
Now we're going to switch. Now you do Glengarry Glen Ross, and I do Heidi Chronicles.
There we go.
Yeah. Yes, a play by the least controversial and toxic playwright of all time. Oh. Yay. David Mamet. Don't ever shut up, David. When reading this play, were there any voices you heard in your head while reading it, like actors who you were imagining in the roles? Because I do that sometimes.
Yeah, well, it's so interesting because I was looking it up too, and I saw that fucking Elizabeth Moss did the revival.
I saw half of that revival.
Oh, did you walk out intermission? Or did you?
Yeah, I did, not because it was bad. I had an audition for Jersey Boys, and I was informed at intermission of Heidi Chronicles that the main casting director, like the person who's really like in charge of all of that, would be leaving soon because it was rather dead at the call and my appointment wasn't for another 2 hours. And they're like, she's going to leave probably in the next 45, but there's no one here, so you can just walk in if you want. And I was like, I am not enjoying this enough to miss being in front of Mary.
For sure.
Yeah. And listen, was it worth it? I didn't end up being in Jersey Boys, but I did get called in for other things. So who's to say? Didn't get any of those either. But for a brief moment, I went, worth not seeing Elizabeth Moss act two breakdown. But I
and
did
also,
see-
like, if you hadn't tried, Matt, maybe it would haunt you wondering if you would have gone on to Jersey Boys. Like, I think exactly. You've got to open every door just for your own sanity.
Yeah, I would have resented Elizabeth Moss forever. But yes, it was really not a very funny production. It was very cold and dry.
Yeah, I've heard that. And I do believe it because I think it's sort of interesting who we're thinking of. Heidi is often described as like an everyman, or dare I say an every woman. And it's like sort of who at the moment is going to be that person. It was so fun to watch, honestly, Jamie Lee Curtis do it in the little TV movie that I obsessively watched last night, where I was like, I'll just watch a clip. And then I was like, no, I will watch all of it.
All of it.
Because it's like, who is that person who's going to sort of like gently hold all of womanhood in her bones? What does it mean for that person to be Heidi in like a world of women? Who do we want to put the spotlight on as like the center of all of this? And I don't know why. So I guess what I'm really saying, it's interesting too, because it's a piece anchored in color, in time. It's a piece anchored in a time period. And it's different now to do this play than it was to do it then and to do it every year in between then and now. And so the question of like, who should lead the Heidi Chronicles if they were to do it again is very interesting to me. I've never seen a woman of color do it. And I think that I would like to see what that changes. I've seen like an actor of color play Susan in a clip that I stalked. But I just think, you know, like the person I think of is Taylor Imman Jones.
Sure.
But I don't know how that's going to ripple out through the piece, and if it'll make it better or if it will make it like sadder.
Well, it's like, do you go for someone who has really dynamic stage presence, or do you go for someone who's really good at kind of being the wallflower? Like, I was thinking, like, what would Nina Arianda do with this? Like, would she, because she is such a vivacious presence. And the thing about Heidi is, like, she's not an extraordinary individual. You know, she's not someone who like is so mind-bogglingly brilliant and interesting and leads this incredible life. What she is, she's very smart, she's very kind, but like, it's, you know how like how more people are finally waking up to the fact that like the not like other girls concept is very sexist?
Yes.
It's not that Heidi is quote unquote, not like other girls. Heidi is Scoop. And we'll talk about this now as we get into the wedding scene, the fight between Scoop and Heidi. If there's one thing Scoop gets right, is that he does not say that Heidi stands alone as a 10. He acknowledges that there are so many women like Heidi, which is great because like Heidi's a smart, successful, driven woman who has also empathy and an ability to, you know, show kindness when maybe she doesn't need to. So it's nice to know that there are plenty of women out there like her, and that this piece of shit Scoop can at least acknowledge that. Now, there's a caveat to that statement, because he follows it up with, and y'all are gonna be miserable.
Yeah, he does.
But I think there is a truth to it though, because when you are smart and are aware that you're smart, when you're able to use your gifts to be successful, it is what you want to do. And when you put all your energy behind one thing and really get so much out of it, there are other things that you're going to want that you'll never get, or maybe you won't get till later, or it won't be exactly what you want. And when you're aware of your value as a human, what you're capable of, and what you're being denied by so many things that are out of your control, it is hard to not let that sadness overwhelm you. We were literally just talking about this, but like so many times the work that we're doing, the people we see, sometimes it's just like a momentary distraction from when you're alone and you're like, and I'm sad. Yeah. Even though I like me, even though I think I'm smart and I'm capable, I am still sad.
Yeah, it's a real curse of intelligence. I think famously one might say ignorance is bliss even.
I've never heard that before. Did you just come up with that?
I actually wrote that just now. I'm a genius.
Good for you. You are a genius.
Thank you. Thank you for noticing that. But I think that there's also like, there's a way in which a piece of shit guys like Scoop make that true. And there's that great little thing that Heidi says in the end in her last scene with Scoop where she says like, maybe one day Pierre Rosenbaum, Scoop's son, and Judy Holland will meet on a plane over Chicago, and like, and he'll never tell her it's either or, baby. Like, and then maybe it won't have to, like, she'll, what does she say? She'll never think she's worthless unless he lets her have it all.
Yeah.
And because maybe things will be a little better. And yes, that does make me happy, says Heidi. And it's like this feeling that some of the profound sadness is like, is societal and like thrust upon us, the way that we feel that we don't fit or we don't make it, or we, and if we just were never told these things were wrong or bad, would we ever feel anything about them? If Scoop didn't feel, have all these opinions about the whole world, I mean, could, you know, could they have been happy together? I don't know. I don't like him. So I think no, but no. You know, he would be a different person, I guess, in that scenario. It's just a question of like, what is the thing?
The healthiest thing Scoop ever did was not marry Heidi.
Yeah, which he says, like, I couldn't leave you dangling anymore. That's why I married her. As which we haven't said yet. And then they kiss at his wedding while the dance he's supposed to be dancing with his wife plays.
Yeah, he's literally supposed to have his first dance with his wife. And the wife ends up having her first dance with Peter.
Peter!
She invites him on the floor. She's like, have my first dance with me. And then so Scoop has his fight with Heidi and then kisses her and then they dance. Although that kiss isn't really like a, we're going to start up again kiss.
Not at all. No, it's like a goodbye, like a painful, twisted.
This chapter kiss. Is over kiss. Yeah.
It's just crazy because it's at his wedding. I love the drama of that. Then you're like, two, oh, this is a play.
And then act two, he's all like, I'm not as much in her life as I used to be, and I'm sad about it. I don't know what happened. It's like, what do you mean you don't know what happened? You got married, motherfucker. You have another life to lead. She's trying to move on.
And there's the idea of, we always ask if women can have it all. Men just assume that they could have it all at this time, that he could have a wife and Heidi and everything. And, you know, in some ways he can, and in some ways he does, and in some ways Scoop also made a choice, and he gave up Heidi, and it was certainly what's best for her, because he sucks. But also, you know, everybody just be out here making choices in pursuit of happiness. Scoop does not seem happy to me. In the last scene that they share, Heidi is the one who seems to have found her way, and mm-hmm. Scoop is, like, flailing around like a man on fire who can't find the fucking... I don't know how you put out a fire, a sink, stop, drop, and roll.
Yeah,
you know?
Scoop is a textbook example of happiness comes from within, and you gotta, you know, get your house in order if you want to find any kind of peace. It's not about the things, it's not about the achievements, it's about getting your own self together. And he never really got himself together. He was so confident and sure of himself, he never really checked in with what it was that he really wanted, only what he thought he could get, what he was worth. And yeah, as you said, now he's flailing. There's something else I was going to say. Fuck.
Happens to the best of us.
It does. It really does. Motherfucker. I keep forgetting what it was I was going to say. Something on Scoop and Heidi's relationship. Oh, the dynamic they have. And so you're quoting Heidi towards the end about their kids, because he has now two kids and she has her adopted baby, and she says she won't feel like she doesn't have value. And I think the line is actually, unless she gives him all of it or something like that.
And he'll never tell her it's either or, baby. And she'll never think she's worthless unless he lets her have it all.
I wonder if my book is different then. Maybe she finally changed it. Let me see. Where is it? Unless he lets her have it all. No, you're right. You're right. That changes then what my original thought was, which was like, it's hard to know sometimes when you are looking out for number one and when you're just being selfish. It's hard to know when you're being supportive or when you're just letting someone take everything you've got to give.
Yeah.
And there is a value you can feel in yourself when someone you think highly of takes from you, because you go, well, they're so great and they want what I have. Clearly, that means I am worth something. But then once they have it and you're left with nothing, the fuck. And that is definitely sort of the attitude of their relationship in Act One. Act Two is much more healthy, mostly due to her own distance. But I would argue she also basically spends the rest of Act Two in that like remaining decade getting back all the things that Scoop and every other man in her life drained from her, which she was not aware was happening because she was also doing all the other things that she told was feminism, like protesting the museum to get women artists, having a career, writing a book. And it's the emotional relationship shit that she wasn't keeping track of, and that's where like so much of her power was getting drained.
So true. And it happens so sneaky, very sneaky how it happens.
That is sneaky how it happens.
Yeah, God, and ain't that life, I'll tell ya. But it's never too late to go after the things you want. And it's just like, there's such a you know, I think that you feel sort of Heidi's happiness, and it's not like an exuberant happiness in the last scene. It's like a quiet happiness, like something that was wrong feels better. Mm-hmm. In like a very subtle way, and it's lovely. It's not all or nothing. It's not like, and then you kiss and happily ever after, fireworks, euphoria for all of time. Life is like a big, long, stretchy thing, and we got to watch 30 years of it with Heidi, and it's a real gift to get to watch 30 years of a life really condensed into a little play like this. And also, we know things at the end, like they can reference things that happened to them 30 years ago, and of course we remember because that was six scenes ago, but we go, oh yes, remember that the day they met when they were just children, and now here they are 30 years later, best friends or ex-lovers or whatever they are. And it's just, that's life. And I think it's always, I love a play like this where you step back and you remember that this is what we have. This is all we have. And God, you better make the choices that make you happy, because what, nobody's going to do it for you. And there isn't more, probably. So God, aren't we lucky to be here right now?
Yeah. Choose happiness, y'all.
Yeah, just do it. Yeah. I'm just kidding. It's really hard, but do it anyway.
It's so hard. And so many people keep on not choosing it. They keep on choosing what they think is what they should do, what they're told to do,
what they think they deserve. You know, guys, just so you know, you deserve the world. You deserve every happiness.
Well, some people don't. But
not all of you. God.
Not all of you. But you know who you are. Exactly. Don't be a Scoop and go for what you are told are the things to do and the people that you think you can get, or that, you know, as Jesse so rightfully said, that you deserve. Not in a positive, like, I'm great, I deserve a good person, but rather like, I'm flawed, so I deserve something that sinks me.
You deserve a good person, indeed.
It's nice.
Yeah.
Good people are nice. Jesse,
yes.
This has been lovely.
Yes, it has been.
Always a pleasure with you. Now, before we wrap things up,
yes,
we have a new game on this podcast. I look forward to seeing if you can help me with this. They are essentially the same game, just with different titles. We are going to do a 6 degrees game with two different women. I can do one because everyone just knows how much I am obsessed with her. It's called 6 degrees of Sally Murphy. Steppenwolf Broadway actress Sally Murphy, currently in Downstate at Playwrights Horizons, where Heidi Chronicles premiered in New York. So we find 6 degrees from the Heidi Chronicles to Sally Murphy. The other one is called Who Lives, Who Dies, Janine Tesori. And guess what? It's just 6 degrees of Janine Tesori.
Well, God, I love Janine Tesori.
As do I. I can very quickly do original production of Heidi Chronicles to Sally Murphy. Peter Friedman was the original Scoop in Heidi Chronicles. He played Tatya in the original Ragtime with Audra McDonald, who was in Carousel with Sally Murphy. Bing, wow. Bang. Yeah.
Gorgeous.
And well, we can do creative teams as well. And I think we could also technically do replacements, but I'm trying not to do revivals.
I could do Janine Tesori, because Janine Tesori just wrote Kimberly Akimbo with David Lindsay Abaire, who wrote Rabbit Hole, which starred Cynthia Nixon, who was in the Heidi Chronicles.
Shut the fuck up. I didn't even make that connection. Look at you, Jesse.
I just was just thinking about all those people. So really luck of the draw.
This is why we pay you the big bucks.
I can't wait for my enormous check in the mail.
It's so funny you call it that, because that's what I call my my friend between my legs is an enormous check. Because once a year my doctor checks on him and he says, that's enormous.
Oh, to be a man. Just kidding. It sounds horrible.
I know. Well, if I ever find out what it's like, I'll let you know. Yeah. Anyway. Jesse, where can people find you if you want them to find you, baby?
Oh, gosh. You can find me at jessefield.com or on Instagram at jsfieldtheater.
Nowhere else? No OnlyFans? No AltTwit? Are you on Hive now?
But if everyone requests an OnlyFans, of course I'm inches away from doing that. Just kidding.
I want to do an OnlyFans with you where it's just us sitting in bed in our underwear discussing feminism.
Fucking finally, Matt. I was waiting for you to ask me. I'll be there.
Yeah.
That's how we're going to keep the podcast afloat.
Woo. And get income from anywhere you can.
Yeah. Plus, we love gay women and gay men in bed together. It'll be so platonic. Oh, my God.
Listen, Will and Grace was on the air for 8 years and then another 4 after that. So anything's possible.
Absolutely true.
If you want to follow me, I'm on Instagram only at Matt Koplik, usual spelling. If you like the podcast, rate, review, subscribe, give us nice 5 stars, give us a nice little ranking. Yeah. We are going to take a quick break after this, about 2 weeks, because this is coming out right around Christmas, right before New Year's. And so we're going to take 2 weeks off and then pick this series back up again in the new year. What show are we covering? I don't know. This whole thing has been out of order. So join us for that then. Jesse, as I'm sure you remember, we do close out with a Broadway diva. I'm trying to think of one who maybe is related to
the Heidi Chronicles,
but I can't really think of any. All these fabulous women don't really sing. SJP does, but we've closed out with her before. Cynthia Nixon famously don't.
Gosh. Jamie Lee Curtis, she doesn't sing. Does she sing in Freaky Friday?
She doesn't. It's the one flaw in her performance in Freaky Friday.
Bummer.
I also love how it's like we kept talking about how Heidi's the every woman, and then in the TV movie it's Jamie Lee Curtis, so I'm like, that woman is so special.
I know. And isn't that the funny part of the world, telling women like Jamie Lee Curtis whatever?
Yeah. Toni Collette, what a basic ugly girl. And I'm like, I'm sorry, that is the most incredible person on earth.
And you all thought, can we not pretend?
Yeah. Can we stop pretending that Toni Collette and Muriel's Wedding is repulsive? She is so beautiful. She's so
gorgeous.
Gorgeous. Yeah. One of my favorite movie reviews is the movie In Her Shoes with Toni Collette and Cameron Diaz. Decent movie. It's a fun movie. But I think it's the Times review, they're like, and you know, Toni Collette is the quote unquote heavier sister. And then in parentheses, they're like, I love how Hollywood thinks a size 8 is plus size.
It's insane. Mm-hmm. Big dislike from me, big thumbs down, as it were. But I do love that movie, actually. I carry your heart in my heart.
It's a funny movie. Well, sometimes funny. It's often very sad. But okay, here's what we're gonna do. We haven't closed out with her yet, and this is very old school. But Wendy Wasserstein's next big play, The Sisters Rosenzweig.
Yes.
Won a Tony Award for one Miss Madeleine Kahn.
All right.
So we're gonna close out with Madeleine Kahn.
Yeah.
A wed woes. Flames on the side of my face.
That's gotcha. Clue. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, Young Frankenstein, Clue, Blazing Saddles, that woman, and What's Up, Doc? So good. Anyway. Yeah, so that's it. Thank you so much for listening, guys. We'll see you in 2 weeks in the new year. And yeah, have a great time. Take us away, Miss Madeleine. Bye!
Never, that is the word I seek. Never, that is the word I seek. comes through that door, I will trample him through the floor. Tell him I'll strangle him.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com and, of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.